So we come this evening to close this chapter in the synthesis of yoga, in the first section of it, the Yoga of Divine Works. It was titled The Sacrifice, the Triune Path, and the Lord of the Sacrifice. And then he revised it. It is an integral knowledge that is being sought, an integral force, a total amplitude of union with the all and infinite behind existence. And again, we know very well by now that the word integral, coming from integer, meaning one, conveys to us the idea of an indivisible being, that there is no absolute demarcation between or among body and life and mind and soul, which constitutes the real person inside of all that vehicle, and that which extends itself as a universe in which this individual experiences and grows and evolves, and the transcendent who is the source of all. An integral knowledge of all this is required and empowered in life, not simply realized inwardly as a great psychological revolution it would be, but to be able to act upon that knowledge, to enforce that knowledge, to bring harmony where there seems to be division. For the seeker of the integral yoga, no single experience, no one divine aspect, however overwhelming to the human mind, sufficient for its capacity, easily accepted as the soul or the ultimate reality, can figure as the exclusive truth of the eternal. So if we have a powerful experience of Advaita Vedanta and the only existent that is, or we have become a communicant to the divine beloved and subside and persist in that felicitous relationship only, or we simply are open to the movement of the divine will as it carries us towards its predestined end, all of these three can vouchsafe to us true realizations. None is exclusive of the other. So no single realization by itself is sufficient. We begin by liberating one part of ourselves, but we have finally to liberate all of ourselves, and all of ourselves must be transformed. For him, the experience of the divine oneness, carried to its extreme, is more deeply embraced and amply fathomed by following out to the full the experience of the divine multiplicity. So a stark oneness of the divine being, the absolute Brahman, beyond all manifestation in time and space, is true, but the divine multiplicity, the manifestation of that one being illimitably to the view, that also is true. Sri Aurobindo accepts both in a still larger realization, one that unites the two. All that is true behind polytheism, as well as behind monotheism, falls within the scope of his seeking. But he passes beyond their superficial sense to human mind to grasp their mystic truth in the divine. So, mystic is an important word. Sri Aurobindo again chose very carefully what words he would use. And if you go to his favorite dictionary, The Chambers, either the one published in 1901 or 1933 when it was reissued, the dictionary draws the origin of the word from the Greek. Forgive my mispronunciation. Main, to close the eyes. In other words, to shut out the appearance of things. From which comes the term mystes, referring to one who has closed the eyes and been initiated. Initiated into what? Initiated into mysteries, mysterion, behind. There is a mystery, and when the knowledge of that mystery is passed on, it is as a secret doctrine. So one who relates to the secret or sacred aspect of mysterious being is a mystic. He passes beyond their superficial sense to human mind to grasp their mystic truth in the divine. He sees what is aimed at by the jarring sects and philosophies and accepts each facet of the reality in its own place, but rejects their narrownesses and errors and proceeds farther till he discovers the one truth that binds them together. Allah Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Aurobindo will be able to unite all possibilities in an enlarged consciousness. The reproach of anthropomorphism and anthropolatry cannot deter him, for he sees them to be prejudices of the ignorant and arrogant reasoning intelligence, the abstracting mind turning on itself in its own cramped circle. Anthropomorphism, rendering human. So if we look at the divine, we make him look like us. Anthropolatry, the worship of a human figure. If human relations, as practiced now by man, are full of smallness and perversity and ignorance, yet are they disfigured shadows of something in the divine, and by turning them to the divine, he finds that of which they are a shadow and brings it down for manifestation in life. So ever small and apparently mundane our relations with each other or the common traits that we share, he's suggesting that they have an origin above and that they stand for a reality which we can restore to the power of the origin through the practice of building our consciousness in life. It is through the human exceeding itself and opening itself to a supreme plenitude that the divine must manifest itself here, since that comes inevitably in the course and process of the spiritual evolution. And therefore, he will not despise or blind himself to the Godhead because it is lodged in a human body, manushim tanum ashritam, which means literally lodged in the human body. And that's Bhagavad Gita 9:11. So, the challenge for the yogin or yogini is going beyond, not simply comfortably farther, but really going beyond, transcending, exceeding the limits of what we are, to redefine ourselves in a more powerful and abundant truth. So we can't let human imperfections obscure the deeper truth that resides within us. We accept our human perfections as fodder, as the material upon which we construct a new being, in partnership with the divine. Beyond the limited human conception of God, he will pass to the one divine eternal, but also he will meet him in the faces of the gods, his cosmic personalities supporting the world play, detect him behind the mask of the vibhutis, embodied world forces or human leaders, reverence and obey him in the guru, worship him in the avatar. So, not only an abstraction, not only that which is aloof and devoid of universal being, not simply that absolute Parabrahman, but this too, this very world, the universe, and all of its forces are representations of divine beings, conscious powers, who actually are the enginery of the world behind the world. So these gods are cosmic functionaries. We can also see the divine not simply in these gods, but also as he manifests in leading personalities and powers and human figures like a Beethoven, like a Napoleon, like an Arjuna. And we can recognize the divine as it speaks, as it leads powerfully through the figure of the guru, the one who has substance, the one who is heavy with the truth, the one who speaks truly because he is truly. And finally, in the incarnate divine, in the avatar. This will be to him his exceeding good fortune if he can meet one who has realized or is becoming that which he seeks for, and can, by opening to it in this vessel of its manifestation, himself realize it. In other words, all the magic of the moment is in the realization. And if that is getting formed in a human, and he is, in a sense, positioned to lead by example another, not so much by instruction, but by influence and example, then great is the good fortune. That is truly an auspicious moment. That is Brahma Muhurta, the hour of the divine. One who is becoming that, and then sharing company, simply being in the presence of one who holds that conscious power within, is itself the gift of the guru. For that is the most palpable sign of the growing fulfillment, the promise of the great mystery of the progressive descent into matter, which is the secret sense of the material creation and the justification of terrestrial existence. In other words, it is through the portals of our consciousness, opened wide, that the descent of the divine comes into and invades directly all the crevices of matter, giving the material extension of the divine the aptitude to awaken to its real nature. Thus reveals himself to the seeker in the progress of the sacrifice, the Lord of the sacrifice. At any point, this revelation can begin. In any aspect, the master of the work can take up the work in him and more press upon him and it for the unfolding of his presence. In time, all the aspects disclose themselves, separate, combine, fuse, are unified together. At the end, there shines through it all the supreme integral reality, unknowable to mind, which is part of the ignorance, but knowable because self-aware in the light of a spiritual consciousness and a supramental knowledge. He divides those words. Spiritual consciousness, as you'll remember from the study of the Gita, refers to the awareness of the omnipresent spirit. Supramental knowledge always brings with it the idea of the empowerment of spiritual reality. Expressively, in which knowledge and will demonstrate all the potentiality of the one and the many. So that closes that section which we left incomplete last week. Now we have a final section. This revelation of a highest truth or a highest being, consciousness, power, bliss, and love, impersonal and personal at once, and so taking up both sides of our own being, since in us also is the ambiguous meeting of a person and a mass of impersonal principles and forces, is at once the first aim and the condition of the ultimate achievement of the sacrifice. So there is a truth of the person, that's the core truth of the soul representing the supreme person here. There is a truth also of the impersonal, the Parabrahman, the Brahman, the abstract, the absolute, the Atman, the impersonal. So when you look for something in the evanescence of the formed personality, you find nothing there, that is the truth of it, because there is an impersonality as well. Both have truth. Both are one. But getting to the truth from which all of that comes, that apparent divide, means arriving again at that which originates it all. He describes it as the highest truth. That would be the supramental manifestation, or a highest being, consciousness, power, bliss, and love. That would be Satchidananda, which manifests itself through the supramental as this universe, holding within itself both impersonality and personality, all possibilities within the richness of its multitudinous one being. So to restore that, to get back to that, to discover that secret, is the first aim of the ultimate achievement of the sacrifice. And what is the sacrifice? The offering of ourselves and all that we are and possess, all we experience, to that, feel it received, and then there is the downflow, the descent of the answering grace from that truth, which represents Satchidananda. Still with me? The achievement itself takes the shape of a union of our own existence with that which is thus made manifest to our vision and experience. And the union has the threefold characters. So the union would be when we're in yoga, yukta, with that. There is a union in spiritual essence by identity. There is a union by the indwelling of our soul in this highest being and consciousness. There is a dynamic union of likeness or oneness of nature between that and our instrumental being here. The first is the liberation from the ignorance and identification with the real and eternal, moksha, sayujya, which is the characteristic aim of the yoga of knowledge. Moksha obviously means release freedom, emancipation. Sayujya means intimate or absolute union. So that's the first, knowledge. The second, the dwelling of the soul with or in the divine, samipya, salokya, is the intense hope of all yoga of love and beatitude. Samipya, neighboring, nearness. Salokya, holding together in the same world or sphere. And this is bhakti yoga. So jnana yoga, bhakti yoga. The third, identity in nature, likeness to the divine, to be perfect as that is perfect, is the high intention of all yoga of power and perfection, or of divine works and service. The combined completeness of the three together, founded here on a multiple unity of the self-manifesting divine, is the complete result of the integral yoga, the goal of its triple path, and the fruit of its triple sacrifice. The high intention of all yoga of power, the worship of the Shakti, the whole tradition of the Divine Mother, the Tantra, the whole field of the Tantra, or of divine works and service, Karma Yoga. Both draw on this aspect. But Sri Aurobindo's position again is that they must fuse. As in the Gita, the Trimarga is a possibility. You begin with one as a base, knowledge, love, works, but you complete the triangle with the other two supporting and lifting up from the base. A union by identity may be ours. A liberation and change of our substance of being into that supreme spirit substance, of our consciousness into that divine consciousness, of our soul state into that ecstasy of spiritual beatitude, or that calm eternal bliss of existence. A luminous indwelling in the divine can be attained by us secure against any fall or exile into this lower consciousness of the darkness and the ignorance, the soul ranging freely and firmly in its own natural world of light and joy and freedom and oneness. And since this is not merely to be attained in some other existence beyond, but pursued and discovered here also, it can only be by a descent, by a bringing down of the divine truth, by the establishment here of the soul's native world of light, joy, freedom, oneness. So this is a power of descent that he brings in here. A union of our instrumental being, no less than of our soul and spirit, must change our imperfect nature into the very likeness and image of divine nature. It must put off the blind, marred, mutilated, discordant movements of the ignorance and put on the inherence of that light, peace, bliss, harmony, universality, mastery, purity, perfection. It must convert itself into a receptacle of divine knowledge, an instrument of divine will, power, and force of being, a channel of divine love, joy, and beauty. So you see how he brings all together here by the empowerment of the descent. So to rest aloof in the heavens above, blissful though they be, to find wide release in moksha into the absolute, great achievements but insufficient for the transformation of the globe. And by the way, while we're on it, the idea of these states of beatitude, Sayujya, Samipya, Salokya, there are four or five that are mentioned as far back as the Mahabharata, maybe earlier, I'm not sure, but certainly they're in the Bhagavata Purana, and include not just these that we've seen here, but also Sarupya, another kind of mukti in which one acquires the sameness of form, and another called Sarshtita, equality in rank, glory, power. So these also are there with Sayujya, the absolute union, and Samipya, being near, and Salokya, dwelling in the same world. This is the transformation to be effected. An integral transformation of all that we now are or seem to be by the joining, yoga, of the finite being in time with the eternal and infinite. So this is multi-leveled and multifaceted. All this difficult result can become possible only if there is an immense conversion, a total reversal of our consciousness, a supernormal entire transfiguration of the nature. Transfiguration is not quite the same thing as transformation. It means to change the appearance or glorify. To change the appearance would mean hopefully changing the substance within, and not simply something cosmetic. I think Sri Aurobindo has the idea of a more substantial change. There must be an ascension of the whole being, an ascension of spirit chained here and trammeled by its instruments and its environment to sheer spirit free above. An ascension of soul towards some blissful super soul, an ascension of mind towards some luminous super mind, an ascension of life towards some vast super life, an ascension of our very physicality to join its origin in some pure and plastic spirit substance. So this is quite important because Sri Aurobindo is talking about the ascent, actually the inner ascent of these parts of our being above to the reality of Paraprakriti, of the supreme nature, the divine nature, whence there is a return that divinizes earth, that divinizes the materia, the vehicle here. Trammeled. This is an interesting trammeled by its instruments. Trammel is a word that comes from fishing, meaning that something that's been captured and confined in a net. In fact, there are a couple of different parts of a trammel. So an ascension that releases us from being trammeled to the sheer spirit. So we escape it. We escape the net of the ignorance and ascend. And this, by the way, and this is something that is resonant in the Veda, where they speak about the seven earths and the ascension from one plane to another. So, quite an important thing. And this cannot be a single swift upsoaring, but like the ascent of the sacrifice described in the Veda, a climbing from peak to peak, in which from each summit one looks up to the much more that has still to be done. So progress by stages. And this is a reference to Rig Veda, first mandala, 10th hymn, second verse. He's translated it differently in a couple of different places in The Life Divine and elsewhere. At the same time, there must be a descent too, to affirm below what we have gained above. On each height we conquer, we have to turn to bring down its power and its illumination into the lower mortal movement. The discovery of the light forever radiant on high must correspond with the release of the same light secret below in every part down to the deepest caves of subconscient nature. This rather continues the Vedic image, where the hound of heaven, Sarma, has to come into the caves of darkness looking for the lost cows, those who represent the radiance, the riches of the divine consciousness, but which have plunged below. As Sri Aurobindo would say later, the superconscience is hidden deeply inside the inconscient. If you go all the way square to the center, to the deepest part of what seems to be utter blackness and chaos, there is the divine light in consciousness too. So to release it, we have to go up, and then we have to come back with the answering descent. And this is also resonant of what we read in Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother, just a couple of months ago. So this ascent and descent is a circle of communion with the divine consciousness. And this pilgrimage of ascension and this descent for the labor of transformation must be inevitably a battle, a long war with ourselves and with opposing forces around us, which, while it lasts, may well seem interminable. For all our old, obscure, and ignorant nature will contend repeatedly and obstinately with the transforming influence, supported in its lagging unwillingness or its stark resistance by most of the established forces of environing universal nature, the powers and principalities and the ruling beings of the ignorance will not easily give up their empire. So this describes the yoga in the ashram from the 1930s on, where the battle was with all the elements of ignorance in our own personal being, with asuric forces behind, and with much more beyond that. And they won't give up. The forces of ignorance won't give up because they perceive no gain in the coming transformation. That would mean forfeiting what they control and possess. That would mean surrendering. They are not about to surrender, either in us or around us. So we have to conquer. So this is the work of the integral yogin, against which the work of the savant who wishes to rise wisely into the divine consciousness and being above and beyond the universe seems simple. There you simply strike off your connection to body, life, and mind, and away you go. Oh, it may take decades to achieve that, but by comparison of what the integral yogin does, it is hop, skip, and a jump. At first, there may have to be a prolonged, often tedious and painful period of preparation and purification of all our being till it is ready and fit for an opening to a greater truth and light or to the divine influence and presence. Even when centrally fitted, prepared, open already, it will still be long before all our movements of mind, life, and body All the multiple and conflicting members and elements of our personality consent or consenting are able to bear the difficult and exacting process of the transformation. So establishing the adhikara, the fitness, doesn't itself signal siddhi is at hand. That is, you've established, you've prepared the ground, now you're ready to work. And hardest of all, even if all in us is willing, is the struggle we shall have to carry through against the universal forces attached to the present unstable creation when we seek to make the final supramental conversion and reversal of consciousness by which the divine truth must be established in us in its plenitude, and not merely what they would more readily permit, an illumined ignorance. In other words, bring your light, stay and visit for a while. We can partially accept your presence, but leave us at our root unchanged. And this the integral yogin cannot do. So, personal, asuric, universal challenges must all be overcome, and it means a plunge into the inconscience with a higher light, with what superconscience we can gather. That is the order, the nature of the business, of the ordeal. Until we have completed it, ignorance will rule the earth. But there's more. It is for this that a surrender and submission to that which is beyond us, enabling the full and free working of its power, is indispensable. It's not up to us. If we surrender, if we can truly submit to the descent of the Mahashakti, she will do it. As that self-giving progresses, the work of the sacrifice becomes easier and more powerful, and the prevention of the opposing forces loses much of its strength, impulsion, and substance. Two inner changes help most to convert what now seems difficult or impracticable into a thing possible and even sure. There takes place a coming to the front of some secret inmost soul within, which was veiled by the restless activity of the mind, by the turbulence of our vital impulses, and by the obscurity of the physical consciousness, the three powers which in their confused combination we now call ourself. There will come about as a result a less impeded growth of a divine presence at the center with its liberating light and effective force, and an irradiation of it into all the conscious and subconscious ranges of our nature. These are the two signs, one marking our completed conversion and consecration to the great quest, the other the final acceptance by the divine of our sacrifice. So, the consecration is the full emergence of the psychic, the true self within, claiming as suzerain all the territory before it, mind, life, and body, and bringing it upwards in a conscious self-giving, all of it. But then there is the effective power of the divine presence, the mother, who comes, and it is her response, the grace answering the call, that indicates the acceptance of the sacrifice. And of course, all this is described in the book, The Mother, isn't it? So the descent is the answer to the question that the soul presents. Will you come? If I give all to you, will you come? You know Sri Aurobindo rewrote the chapter. It might be worth hearing, though, how he originally closed a much briefer chapter that appeared in the Arya. It's just a couple of sentences. Thus, the complete and integral knowledge develops, embracing devotion and works in its scope, fulfilling them and itself fulfilled by them. By that knowledge, we are able to enter into a perfect relation with life and the universe. Ourselves anchored in that of which life and the universe are only an expression. Transcendent, universe, individual. So next week we take up chapter 5, the ascent of the sacrifice. Yes, this has all been preparing to take us more dynamically into it, where he continues what was adumbrated in the Rig Veda, matured in the Bhagavad Gita, still farther into reaches appropriate to an integral quest. So that is next week. We're still in Savitri, in the Book of Beginnings, Book 1, and Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge. This is irresistible. Too beautiful not to read it. The master of existence lurks in us and plays at hide-and-seek with his own force. In nature's instrument loiters secret God. The immanent lives in man as in his house. He has made the universe his pastime's field, a vast gymnasium of his works of might. All-knowing, he accepts our darkened state. Divine wears shapes of animal or man. Eternal, he assents to fate and time. Immortal, dallies with mortality. The all-conscious ventured into ignorance. The all-blissful bore to be insensible. Incarnate in a world of strife and pain, he puts on joy and sorrow like a robe and drinks experience like a strengthening wine. He whose transcendence rules the pregnant vasts, prescient now dwells in our subliminal depths, a luminous individual power alone. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has called out of the silence his mute force, where she lay in the featureless and formless hush, guarding from time by her immobile sleep the ineffable puissance of his solitude. The absolute, the perfect, the alone, has entered with his silence into space. He has fashioned these countless persons of one self. He has built a million figures of his power. He lives in all who lived in his vast alone. Space is himself, and time is only he. The absolute, the perfect, the immune, one who is in us as our secret self, our mask of imperfection has assumed. He has made this tenement of flesh his own, his image in the human measure cast, that to his divine measure we might rise. Then, in a figure of divinity, the Maker shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. This transfiguration is earth's due to heaven. A mutual debt binds man to the supreme. His nature we must put on as he put ours. We are sons of God and must be even as he. His human portion we must grow divine. Our life is a paradox with God for key. But meanwhile, all is a shadow cast by a dream, and to the musing and immobile spirit, life and himself don the aspect of a myth, the burden of a long, unmeaning tale. For the key is hid, and by the inconscient kept. The secret God beneath the threshold dwells, in a body obscuring the immortal spirit, a nameless resident vesting unseen powers with matter shapes and motives beyond thought and the hazard of an unguessed consequence, an omnipotent, indiscernible influence, he sits, unfelt by the form in which he lives, and veils his knowledge by the groping mind. A wanderer in a world his thoughts have made, he turns in a chiaroscuro of error and truth to find a wisdom that on high is his. As one forgetting, he searches for himself. As if he had lost an inner light, he seeks. As a sojourner lingering amid alien scenes, he journeys to a home he knows no more. His own self's truth he seeks, who is the truth. He is the player who became the play. He is the thinker who became the thought. He is the many who was the silent one. In the symbol figures of the cosmic force, and in her living and inanimate signs, and in her complex tracery of events, he explores the ceaseless miracle of himself till the thousandfold enigma has been solved in the single light of an all-witnessing soul. This was his compact with his mighty mate, for love of her, and joined to her forever, to follow the course of time's eternity, amid magic dramas of her sudden moods, and the surprises of her masked idea, and the vicissitudes of her vast caprice. Two seem his goals, yet ever are they one, and gaze at each other over bornless time. Spirit and matter are their end and source. A seeker of hidden meanings in life's forms, of the great mother's wide uncharted will and the rude enigma of her terrestrial ways, he is the explorer and the mariner on a secret inner ocean without bourne. He is the adventurer and cosmologist of a magic earth's obscure geography. In her material order's fixed design, where all seems sure, and even when changed, the same, even though the end is left forever unknown, and ever unstable is life's shifting flow, his paths are found for him by silent fate. As stations in the age's weltering flood, firm lands appear that tempt and stay a while, then new horizons lure the mind's advance. There comes no close to the finite's boundlessness. There is no last certitude in which thought can pause, and no terminus to the soul's experience. A limit, a farness, never wholly reached. An unattained perfection calls to him from distant boundaries in the unseen. A long beginning only has been made. Namaste. Jai Ma.